Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, October 26th. It's 8 days before Election Day, and an incredible 60 million people have already voted. For context, that's 13 million more people than early voted in all of 2016. For additional context, think of this. 130 million total votes were cast in 2016. If it's the same this year, it means almost half of all votes have already been cast with 8 days to go. If you're a Democrat, there are also tantalizing signs of a really big turnout of young voters in swing states, something that's often predicted but rarely actually happens. According to stats compiled by Tufts University, Michigan, for example, had about 7,000 early votes from people under 30 at this point in 2016. It's already up to 145,000. 7,000 last time, 145,000 this time. You can see similar trends in Florida and North Carolina and other swing states. What that means is the difference in early turnout this year is big for all age groups, but it's bigger among voters under 30 than for others. Now, this could all be outweighed eventually because Republicans are tending to vote later than Democrats, but these youth turnout numbers are encouraging for the Dems and historically different than what we tend to see. And as voting season is in full swing, the White House has another coronavirus outbreak. Since we last spoke on Friday, they revealed that five people close to Mike Pence have tested positive for the virus, including his chief of staff, who Pence was in close contact with. So far, Pence himself is negative, but is Pence going to quarantine for a few days, as CDC guidelines say that Americans should do, and not campaign in person? Take a guess. On ABC This Week yesterday, co-host Martha Raddatz brought that up with former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who, of course, got the virus himself from hanging around with Trump and Pence and without a mask or social distancing last month. This starts with Martha Raddatz's question.
The Joint Chiefs of Staff quarantined when they were exposed to coronavirus. Does the White House still just not get it?
Well, I think that the whole getting of COVID to begin with and the not wearing of masks has been a problem. And I've talked about that over the last couple of weeks. And so I think everybody's got to put the health of the people they're going to be in touch with first. When I found out that I got COVID that Friday morning, I immediately quarantined myself. And ultimately wound up in the hospital. But you got to keep yourself away from everybody, and I'm a little bit surprised.
Chris Christie, now out of the hospital with personal regrets and new judgment of his Trump world peers. This is also the day that Amy Coney Barrett will probably be confirmed by the Senate and actually sworn in as early as tonight to the United States Supreme Court. With me now, Amber Phillips, reporter for the Washington Post politics blog called The Fix. She also writes the daily email newsletter, The 5-Minute Fix. Amber, I'm sure this is going to be a what do I write about first kind of busy day for you. So we really appreciate some time. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's exactly that day, Brian. I'm so happy to be on.
I don't know if this latest White House outbreak and Pence ignoring the quarantine guidelines changes anyone's vote, but how do you see it in political terms?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm going to the WashingtonPost.com and looking at the main headline we have here, I think it couldn't be more politically devastating, Brian, 8 days before the election. It is White House gives up on trying to slow virus spread. I mean, that is not a headline in combination with this news that, the coronavirus is still spreading in the White House, including among aides to Pence who have been very skeptical of social distancing and mask wearing and shutting down the economy earlier this spring. And then you add on that the president got it 3 weeks ago. And then you add on this weekend And Friday, that, you know, estimates are we hit 80,000 infections in America, the highest yet. The death toll is up. This is exactly where the Trump campaign did not want to be, I would imagine.
You know, I was just going to bring up that Washington Post lead story with you. And it's funny, I guess maybe a little behind the scenes here of how media organizations work is they'll put out different headlines for the same story and see which catches on. Because the one on my app is just a little bit different from what you said, White House gives up. Mine is White House signals defeat in pandemic. Same thing, slightly different words, as coronavirus outbreak roils Pence's office. And it centers your article, or your colleague's article, centers this clip that I will play from CNN's State of the Union yesterday with White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows telling CNN's Jake Tapper, we're not going to control the pandemic. Listen.
On your website yesterday, Jake, your website is talking about, well, now we think the spread is coming from small social groups and family groups. First, it was large groups. Now it's small groups.
It's
now
coming from all sorts of places.
Well,
that's
exactly
the pandemic's out of control.
So here's what we have to do. We're not going to control the pandemic. We are going to control the fact that we get vaccines, therapeutics, and other mitigation areas.
Why aren't we going to get control of the pandemic?
Because it is a contagious virus, just like the flu.
Yeah, but why not make efforts to contain it?
Well, we are making efforts to contain it.
By running all over the country, not wearing a mask?
Jake,
that's what the vice president's doing.
We can get into the back and forth. Let me just say this. Is what we need to do is make sure that we have the proper mitigation factors, whether it's therapies or vaccines or treatments, to make sure that people don't die from this.
Mark Meadows, White House Chief of Staff, with CNN's Jake Tapper. Amber Phillips from The Washington Post is with us. And Amber, yeah, I was flabbergasted as I was up early watching that on TV yesterday. So did Mark Meadows misspeak there in a fast-paced exchange with Jake Tapper? Did they try to walk that back later? Or was he really signaling defeat in trying to control the number of cases?
Based on everything I've seen since, I have not seen an attempt for the White House to walk it back. Maybe that comes later today. He was signaling defeat. I mean, those words are echoing today across every, you know, news organization, and certainly it's what we're talking about, Brian. We're not going to control the pandemic. That's an exact quote from that clip you just played from the White House Chief of Staff, no less. You know, I also pulled up to read what Joe Biden said, because immediately it was just like manna from heaven for him politically. You know, he called this, you know, to wave the white flag of defeat and hope that by ignoring it, the virus would simply go away has been the president's strategy. It hasn't and it won't. So, you know, is this just another opportunity for Biden to try to pitch himself as the much more careful one? And there's a little bit of that jockeying going on between the vice president and then the vice presidential candidate on the Democratic side, Harris, who said, hey, when a top aide that I was around, you know, tested positive, I quarantined for a little bit. You know, I think we've modeled the right and good behavior, she said. Meanwhile, Pence was in North Carolina Sunday. He's planning to go to Minnesota today. He might even be at the Senate to help confirm Amy Coney Barrett. It's just, you know, both stories are going to kind of potentially weave together this evening. It's just a very different approach. And it's, I think it's underscored by Mark Meadows saying flat out, we're not going to control the pandemic.
And he talks about therapeutics. The president says the same thing all the time, like, hey, I got it. I'm fine. You'll probably be okay, too, if and when you get it. But I prefer to talk about deaths rather than cases when we try to put stats on this, because the record cases this weekend, which have been so much in the news, can be an artifact of more testing, like the president says. But in the last week, an average of 800 people each day have died from the virus in this country. 2 weeks ago, that was 700 people a day, which was bad enough. But it's up by 100 deaths a day just in the last 2 weeks. So we've got a real policy debate on our hands, I guess, if you want to call it that, Amber. Trump and an exposed Pence are still convening big maskless, not socially distanced crowds, and Biden is not, and we'll see how it affects the election and people's health.
Well, yeah, I want to add one stat to the desk, because I think you're right, Brian, to look at that. And public health experts warn that these cases, those 80,000, are going to, in a couple of weeks, lead to even more deaths. New daily reported deaths in the U.S., according to the Washington Post tracker, rose 11.4% in the past week. So up, everything's up. And I just, you asked, you know, we'll see how this is going to affect the election. We're seeing it, right? Like in polls nationally and in swing states and in red states, especially, President Trump is down. An example that I love to cite is he won Montana by 20 points or a little bit more in 2016. Mm-hmm. A high quality New York Times Siena College poll last week, I think it was, had him leading at about 7 points. And largely because of that, a Senate race tie that could help Democrats in their step to getting a Senate majority and thus, you know, control of governing in Washington entirely next year. It just, what he's doing and their strategy you just outlined is politically not resonating with America, including in red states. And I'll add one more thing. What we're seeing is cases in red states in rural areas are what's driving this increase in infections days before the election.
Want to hear from some New York early voters? Beth on the Lower East Side. Beth, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Thank you so much for taking my call. So I live on the Lower East Side. Our early voting place is on Henry Street. So my husband and I went on Saturday. We got there around 10:30. The line was just forever. It would have taken us maybe 3 or 4 hours. So we live right around the corner. So we decided to come back. We went back yesterday, and it took us from start to finish, maybe 30 minutes, but the atmosphere was so joyous. People were taking pictures of each other. The poll workers were just so, there were tons of poll workers, and they were just so, you know, helpful, and thank you for coming. And it just, I when we left, both my husband and I, we really got choked up. It was really emotional, and I just felt so proud, and just, it's one of those moments I just think, oh, my God, I love this town. And it was very
Have you ever
emotional.
Had that feeling before, like 2008 voting for Obama? I'm guessing you're a Democrat.
Yes.
Or anything
yes.
else?
Yes, I'm a big, as a matter of fact, I've called into your show before on Election Day. I always say I'm my most self-righteous on Election Day. I usually do get out to vote. I typically go to Pennsylvania, but unfortunately, I won't this year because I'm in my late 60s, so I'll do some phone banking. But yes, I do. I get I'm kind of a voting nerd, so I do get emotional. But yesterday seemed particularly poignant.
What a scene with exuberance outside. Aru, thank you, Beth. Aru in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi there. Thanks for calling in.
My pleasure. I'm listening to WNYC for the longest time. And myself and my husband, we were lucky to be at Creedmoor Early Voting Center. We were there around 7:15, and everything was so orderly. It was really, really enjoyable. And we finished all our voting process in 45 minutes.
45 minutes. That was this morning, right?
This morning, yes, sir.
Yes. So you probably were smart to wait till early voting day 3 instead of trying.
Actually, we were contemplating voting on Saturday, but we figured that Saturday would be weekend. Many people who are working, students and everybody, they would be free and be online. So we changed our mind and opted for this morning.
Did you experience that same exuberance among people around you that our first caller did?
Exuberance, I would not say, but everybody was very orderly, very friendly. It was very smooth process.
Aru, thank you so much for calling. We appreciate it. Please call us again. All right. So Aru had 45 minutes this morning in Queens. Looks like Steve on the Upper West Side had over 4 hours this weekend. Steve, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hey, Brian. Yes, I waited online to vote yesterday for 4 hours and 15 minutes up at 101st Street.
Wow. Why?
Yes. Why? Because it's tremendously important. And while there were moments of levity and while people were friendly and socialized among each other on the line. There was also, in my opinion, it also could have been because I was underdressed and freezing, a sense that, you know, what we were doing required a lot of effort, and it required a lot of effort because of the situation being so serious. The situation is dire. And so even though there were moments of levity, I think overall there was a sense almost like a going off to war sense, that this was an incredibly important time and that we were beholden to be out there and do it.
Did you consider for yourself waiting until the weekdays so you wouldn't wait 4 hours and 15 minutes? Or did people talk about that, choosing to buck that line because they could have waited like Aru did until today or tomorrow or the next day?
Yeah, I mean, I did think about that. I live not so far away from the voting place, but I wasn't sure the lines were going to be any shorter any of these days, and it's going to be rainy today. It is rainy today. As I look out my window, I do not see the line actually today at all. So maybe that would have been the wiser decision. I felt it was important to vote as soon as possible as well. I felt there was an urgency simply to be counted as soon as possible, to be part of that momentum, that part of that hopefully bigger wave in terms of number of voters than ever before.
Steve, thank you so much for your call. One more for the moment, then we'll get back to Amber Phillips from The Washington Post and hear how she's hearing all of you. Gail in Oceanside, you're on WNYC. Hi, Gail.
Hi. I went with my 93-year-old mother who refused to use a mail-in ballot, and it was important for her to, as she did most of her life, go directly to the polls. We had to go to the town of Lawrence at a country club, which in itself sounded like a thrill for my mom. But I could not get information ahead of time for accommodations for somebody that aged, a super senior. Mm-hmm. And there was a line all around a parking lot, but I saw a sign near the front entrance. There was a poll worker who immediately came over and scooted her to the front of the line.
Oh, good.
Along with me and my husband. And it was the most joyous thing I remember doing all year, which for this year doesn't sound like a big deal, but it was.
What was the scene? I could imagine Oceanside, and for people who don't know, Oceanside, South Shore of Long Island, could be politically mixed, right?
It could have been, but we went to the an area that is Orthodox, and it was Saturday. So we thought maybe there were fewer people in line, but still my son and his wife went an hour before we did. And when we were exiting, we saw them first get to the front of the line. They had been online for 2 hours.
Right. But you didn't experience any tension, like if there were a lot of Trump voters and a lot of Biden voters kind of glowering at each other or anything like that.
You just had a lot of happy voters, happy to be their voters, very excited, like effervescent feeling.
Gail, thank you so much. By the way, how's it there in Oceanside this morning? Is it all misty and foggy over the water? Can you see the water?
I don't see the water. It's just murky.
Yeah.
Murky stuff.
Thank you very much. Thanks so much. So, Amber Phillips from The Washington Post, you're hearing stories like this all over the country?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Those are such lovely stories, too, people excited to go vote. And, I mean, you started your show, Brian, with the numbers, which are pretty astounding, at least by American political election barometers, how many people are excited to vote. And then, you know, of course, we're talking in New York, which tends to be a Democratic region, but
right.
We are seeing nationwide that those early voting, those voters going to early vote with all that excitement are Democratic, which only makes Democrats feel like their blue wave is building. One thing I'll say is I talked to strategists in South Carolina where there's a competitive Senate race going on, and
Lindsey Graham, we should say, in a competitive race for his own seat, right?
Yeah, a bold name in the Senate, a bold national name, Lindsey Graham, which is just, I was just writing a story for We Talk to the surprises potentially of 2020. Unseating Lindsey Graham would be number one there. And anyways, Politico's there in South Carolina said they've never seen early voting lines like that. So I think what's happening in New York seems to be happening throughout the nation, and it's a sign of Democratic enthusiasm in particular, which makes Republicans worried.
Gloria Pazmino, political reporter for our local station, New York One, just retweeted someone who sent a photo of a huge line this morning at the Brooklyn Museum in the rain. Looks like thousands of people to this tweeter. So even today in the rain, not the weekend, if that photo is what it looks like to be. What do you make of those young voter turnout numbers? And for people who didn't hear them at the start, I was citing things from Tufts University statistics that, like in Michigan, big swing state, for example, about 7,000 early votes came by this date from people under 30 in 2016, about 7,000. It's already up to 145,000. That's just early votes in Michigan among people under 30. And the point being, yeah, there's a lot of early voting in general, but proportionately it's even more among young voters than among other people. And of course, that would be good for Democrats if it's statistically meaningful, but I don't know how to tell if it is.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, I don't think we will know until after the election and we see in by what percentage younger voters came out and according to exit polls, which we can track this stuff with, who they voted for. But you're right, Brian, that young voters tend to benefit Democrats in particular. And that's one of the missing pieces of their puzzle to electoral victory nationally and in congressional and Senate races and state house races and governor's races is young people say they're really interested, we're starting to see, but then just don't follow through to vote in any high numbers. I tracked that particularly with Bernie Sanders' primary campaign, which we know drove a lot of excitement among young voters. And in 2020, you know, every state he would say, young people, I really need you to vote so I can win this state. And they just wouldn't. That's starting to change in the general election on a much more national scale.
We just have a few minutes left, but I want to get to a little bit of more of your reporting. You know, on any other day when a Supreme Court justice was about to be confirmed, probably that day, that would be the lead story. Here we are, half hour into the show, and we haven't even gotten to it yet. But Amy Coney Barrett will most likely be confirmed tonight, just in time for Election Day lawsuits. But even without her, you have an article called "The Supreme Court is Giving Advocates for Voting Rights Heartburn." How are they doing that?
Sure. You know, the court is split right now, but Amy Coney Barrett will be on it later, as you said, almost certainly later this week. And what voting advocates tell me is that even a split court has conservatives signaling that they're willing to reconsider voting laws from what they think is a very drastic perspective. For example, one thing that kept popping up is this concept that a deadline means a deadline. November 3rd, if your ballot's not in by November 3rd, that's it. You know, there's no exceptions for if it got postmarked. So there were four justices in a Pennsylvania case that signaled that. And North Carolina Republicans saw that and immediately appealed their loss on stopping at the deadline to the Supreme Court. We could hear the court rule on a similar issue in Wisconsin any minute now. And the reason voting right experts in particular were concerned about that is they argued to me, you know, hey, like in law, let's say you're trying to mail out, you know, your mortgage payment or something like that, you would be upheld in court if you got it out on the deadline. And the post office is what delayed you. And so they were kind of surprised that there were so many justices willing to rethink, according to voting rights advocates, how voting gets done in America.
And it's amazing that the voting is so in full swing, as we've been discussing, and they're still arguing
right
about the rules in court in so many places. So last thing, and then I'll let you go to the 14 other jobs you have to do before lunch. You also have an article called "The Secretaries of State and Election Officials You May Be Hearing About on Election Day," including Michigan's Jocelyn Benson, Pennsylvania's Kathy Buchvar, Florida's Laura Lee, Arizona's Kathy Hobbs, and you cite their parties, all Democrats except for Laura Lee in Florida, What do these secretaries of state do, and does party matter to the vote counting ahead that they oversee?
Yeah, well, the goal for them, they tell me if they've had a successful job running this election, is to not have party matter. But we're in a partisan environment, so I would argue parties always matter. And so what these secretaries of state do is exactly what I said. Their job is to run an election. There's a National Association of Secretaries of State, and those people there like to say there's no national election. There are 50-plus territory elections. It's up to each state with their own rules on how to do this. And that's particularly difficult for secretaries of state in these times, right, with the pandemic and the hyper-partisanship and the concerns of misinformation they've all talked to me about. So what I tried to do was look at secretaries of state that could be in the news after November 3rd. What if we're waiting on vote counts in Michigan? What if we're waiting on vote counts in Pennsylvania or Wisconsin or any number of these other states, Arizona, Florida? Who is out there telling us, you know, what the latest count is, whether they'll accept X number of ballots after the deadline, you know, defending how they counted their state's results in court, if that's the case, and we fully expect both sides to be ready to litigate those results if things are close. So these anonymous, mostly election officials who, yes, are partisan, but when they run an election, try not to be partisan, could suddenly become like major figures on the national stage.
So listeners, be ready to hear those names again and be ready to read the name Amber Phillips. If you follow her on Twitter, her Twitter handle, a reporter to the end, is at by Amber Phillips. So it's a byline at by Amber Phillips. And for the Washington Post's site, The Fix, and the 5-Minute Fix, Daily Washington Post Politics email newsletter. Amber, thanks for so much time today. We really appreciate it. Keep it up.
Thanks for having me on, Brian. I'll go tweet those stories out so people can read them.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.